Good evening and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 1st, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, Mary Scott Boria continues her study on social justice, transforming a vision. Tonight's topic is entitled Current Issues in Racial Healing, Reparations. This is session SBM 2000-5. Let's listen in.
Will come as they come.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if the bell went off last night. Well, good evening. About half are new faces and the other half are not old faces, but warm faces. For those of you who are, this is your first time here with me, my name is Mary Scott Boria. My bio is out on the thing, the kiosk out in the front. But I am have for the last, I guess, probably 20 years been engaged in both a struggle against racism as well as thinking about where we are at current times in history around the question of race. And so I would say every 5 years, I'm compelled to think about either new directions around the question of race, as most people are in this country, because I think we're beleaguered by the lack of solutions in some of the old ways in which race and racism has been approached. But because I see the movement and development sometimes backwards, but oftentimes forward on the question of race. And so this whole issue of reparations and the current conversations around reparations are extremely interesting to me. And so I have been opening up myself to the conversation around reparations, and I'm saying that to say I have not the expertise in the topic of reparations, and will probably do less talking tonight than I did last night, because I think what is posed for us by people who are currently, I think, really trying to push this issue into sort of a public discussion are the ones that are sort of raising the question. So I'd like to have some conversation, and I'll be here the whole week, and next Friday or next Saturday, we'll probably have some more conversations around the question of reparations. And so looking forward to your informed discussion together and with me around this whole issue of reparations. So I'll get into that in a few seconds. But I kind of want to say sort of where I've been this week, real briefly, so for those of you who are new, have a sense of kind of where I sort of see myself in terms of today. For the last 4 days, we've been discussing sort of racism, and I've been kind of looking at the question of power and the power of race and the power of blackness in this country, the cost of blackness, and what the price of whiteness is, and kind of looking at what it means to be white in the United States, and what is the price that white people pay for racism, and not just the other side of the equation, what's been the cost for African Americans, for other people of color. And by the way, I'm African American, so I only speak from that perspective, though I clearly understand and embrace the need to be much more holistic and multicultural in my understanding about race in the United States and around the world. I can only speak from my own personal experience, and hopefully it's engaging of other, hopefully it's not exclusive of other people of color's experience. So in thinking about sort of where we sort of enter into this discussion about race, I think that what has happened over the last 5 years is that there certainly has been, and maybe even 10 years, certainly have been a move away from looking at people of color as the problem, and people of color as needing the solution, and looking at whiteness and looking at what racism has done to white society as a way to engage, I think, some honest dialogue about what the loss in this country has been around the question of race. Now, I say that very cautiously because I understand very clearly that the benefits in this society have been to white society, and that to bring whites into the discussion about loss without an understanding about benefit, then what it does, it just isn't sort of another way to package the whole race discussion that I think leads us down the road to more of a feeling of betrayal on the part of people of color. But certainly the work in the last 10 years have been really looking at this issue of whiteness. I was on the computer about a year ago, one night, looking at in the internet, you know. You kind of go from one button to the next, and it leads you someplace else, and then it leads you someplace else. And, you know, you end up someplace where you hadn't planned to be if you sit there long enough. And I entered into this catalog, the Library of Whiteness. And, you know, my first thought was, uh-oh. And my husband, who came into the room, didn't know what I was doing, looked at the computer and saw Library of Whiteness and wasn't quite sure what I was doing either. And what it was is that it is a wonderful catalog of thousands and thousands of resources and people studying this question about what does it mean to be white in the United States, and what does it mean, because certainly we don't think of race from that perspective. We sort of think of it from the other's perspective. So, you know, I mean, everybody has engaged this conversation about the question of white as an identity, white as a sign of privilege, and what's the alternative for white society if we've posed race in sort of a sociological way. So we sort of spent some time this week kind of thinking about that. And that for me, whiteness represents a prison for white people. It represents a prison. Now, I don't equate that prison with the prison that people of color have suffered, but there certainly is a prison, and that there is a price to be paid for privileges that have been gotten at the benefit of other groups in our society, and to sort of think about what that prison is. And I think for people of color, the discussion has been, unless whites come to terms with that, the future of dialogue is null and void, because that understanding about the other side of that equation and about what that means to freedom for people of color as well, for whites, is limited. And so the notion of being in a prison and understanding what that prison is and what it's done, both in terms of sort of the psychological cost to the separation of the races, as well as to the future, if we continue to understand how the races continue to be separate, and the cost that we all pay for that, then there is a prison that becomes more and more obvious. And so, kind of thinking about that, some of the ways in which some of us have thought about what does it mean to understand what freedom means for white people. And remember, I had like a whole week to talk about this. So for some of you are saying, what the heck is she talking about? I'll be talking about it again this week. So please come back. sort of this notion about freedom and what it means to be free, that whites have to understand their own prison, and that some ways of understanding it, and this is what kind of lead us into some conversation about reparations, that it's about a systemic understanding of how you are white collectively and not necessarily individually, but that the individual work for whites to understand that prison and to get out of that prison rests on several points that I'll just make before I move into this. One is understanding racism, understanding clearly racism and its manifestations. And I can't say that strong enough. Really understanding racism and its manifestations. And then individually struggling against racism. And being in community with other people who struggle against racism. And understanding that non-racism denies the prison. And that being a non-racist is another way of being a racist. And taking responsibility to destroy the prison. And working for anger instead of guilt. None of us like anger. But guilt is more harmful, I think. And then recalling the past and discovering your own personal histories and how you were made into a racist in the United States. And I have to say that I have appreciated, you know, when you go off someplace, sort of like kind of a retreat kind of thing, you kind of have some idea of what you'd like to get out of it, you know, exercise, sleep, you know, someone giving you good food, you know, you look for all those things. I have to, and you always come home with something quite unexpected. I have to say that for me, the unexpected treat, at least of this week, is really understanding about the German church history. I'm not Lutheran, I'm not German, and I'm not white. But we always do in our racism training, we do a wall of history. And it's like these papers up around the wall, and we construct a wall of history. And on that wall of history, we ask for people to identify on the top of the line, you know, historical facts and people and events that signify racism. And then on the bottom of that line, we ask people to put the same thing related to resistance to racism. And it's always amazing to me, in the midst of that, how little understanding white people have of their resistors to oppression, and how easy it is to identify sometimes people of color resistors, but to how difficult it is to hold up resistors in your own race, amongst your own people, that fight against my oppression. And so that, to me, to know about that and to understand that, it was extremely enriching and hopeful to me. So I appreciate that, and I will go home, and that will, and I will spend some time really understanding that, because I think that's a bridge. I think that's a bridge that we can hold up. And so recalling and understanding your own history and understanding those places where there was resistance. I mean, I suspect you're all here because there's some history of resistance in your life, and understanding what that has meant to understanding this notion about oppression and your own oppression. And then finally, sort of the spiritual understanding of remembering that in our baptism we were made free, but that we were also made to resist evil. Now, I'm going to be going to the School of Theology next year. So if I come back here in a couple of years, I'll be able to quote those scriptures for you. But now I won't do that. But I do understand that the notion of baptism is about freedom, but it's also about resisting sin. And I think understanding racism and fighting against it in your personal life is about resisting sin and resisting evil. And then there are other sort of images of individual freedom that you know, people have sort of lifted up. Some people think of slavery as insanity or mental health. That, you know, that racism is an insanity, and we certainly see examples of that. And some people would like to see that as an individual insanity. So when we see hate crimes, when we see young people killing each other, when we see those kinds of things, when we see Matthew Hale and whatever his group is called, sort of the young Nazis, you know, so as individual acts of insanity, it's the insanity of living in a society that has nothing but lies about its relationship to each other. And then there are those who sort of think about this prism as addiction and recovery. And some people who are involved in sort of the addiction and recovery understand that you can't stop the addiction, that it's never cured. So, you know, one of the things that we think about often in our racism training is that as individuals, you can't stop being a racist. Your only salvation is figuring out how to develop a different identity, an identity that says I'm a resistor to racism because I'm a part of a system here and I can't stop. The only hope is to be a part of a collective, but that the folks who do addiction and recovery understand that, and they acknowledge the disease, you acknowledge the disease of racism, admit helplessness to it, accept responsibility, and work for recovery. And then sort of the corporate responsibility has to do with understanding that resisting racism is a corporate action, that in addition to individual work, that it's about corporate action, it's about collective action, that we're responsible to escape this prism as a collective, joining under the leadership of people of color. And what does that mean? And that the responsibility we expect, that the responsibility that white people have is that they struggle with each other. That they don't struggle with us, but they struggle with each other. So that was a little bit about some of what we did last week, and kind of looking at this whole notion of race and white identity. So today I kind of wanted to do something that was a little more about sort of what are some current themes or current issues around race that that I think are going to have gain some importance in the next few years. And I think this whole question around reparations is that issue that I think will be at the forefront. I wanted to start out by reading, I love this poem. One of my students at Urban Studies did her independent study on Gwendolyn Brooks. Gwendolyn Brooks is from Chicago. She's an African American, and she's a poet laureate of Illinois. But this is kind of the basis of the argument around why reparations, and this is her poem. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. So what is the cost? I mean, reparations is about payment, right? So there's a cost, there's a price tag. And this theme, heirs to the promise, I've been kind of trying to think about, heirs to the promise. So I thought, okay, who are the heirs? We're all supposed to be the heirs, right? We're all supposed to be embraced in God's kingdom. We're supposed to be heirs to God's promise for salvation, for whatever, right? I don't know if we think that we're the heirs. And certainly the Bible has been used in ways that says that some of us are heirs and some of us aren't heirs to the promise, and that the promise is for the chosen people. And so we have sort of a history at least the in many ways the Bible has been interpreted by many as heirs, for white people as heirs, and certainly in this country, and that the promise not for us. But on the flip side of that, the Bible has been a source of strength, survival, inspiration, and struggle for people of color. So, you know, sort of thinking about this theme, heirs to the promise, and sort of what does reparations have to do with that. I don't know how many of you know of Randall Robinson's work. You familiar with Randall Robinson? Randall Robinson led in the 80s the anti-apartheid movement, the United States anti-apartheid movement against South Africa, and struggled for a very, the United States was one of the last countries to really join in on the sanctions question, the sanctions against South Africa. We were one of the very last countries to do that. And I think that the sanctions against South Africa was one of the major reasons why the country finally, you know, it's an interesting revolution, right? I don't even know what the word is. The country finally changed. I think had a lot to do with the sanctions. And Randall Robinson was one of the leaders of that movement here in the United States, and certainly was one of the ones that sort of called the question to Congress, but also I think called the question to Black America to think about their involvement and their understanding of South Africa. So he he's not the only one, and he certainly isn't the first, who's sort of bringing the issue of reparations to sort of some public light. I want to just read what it says here, see if I can read something here. Well over a century after the end of slavery, Black Americans are still poor, less educated, and earning less than their white counterparts. Statistics reveal that they lag behind whites in nearly every area of mainstream American life. In Robinson's view, this great divide cannot be bridged or our racial problems solved until two things happen. One, America must accept responsibility for the grievous wrong that has been committed against Africans and African Americans and take steps to redress that wrong. And Black Americans need to arm themselves with a more comprehensive awareness of their ancient history and a fuller recognition of their ongoing contribution to our nation and the world. And so this is kind of what is the work that is the book is based upon. Now the whole reparations debate is kind of set in the context that there have been in the last several years some precedents set for reparations. Certainly the Jewish question and the reparations in Germany to the Jews in Germany and the reparations to the state of Israel, reparations for the Japanese very recently, some isolated or some situations around the country for indigenous people in this country. How many of you are familiar with Rosewood? Anybody? Rosewood. Yeah, where's Rosewood?
I don't remember, but I certainly remember this
movie. Rosewood, it was a movie that came out, and many of us hadn't even heard of Rosewood until the movie came out.
Florida?
Rosewood, Florida. Do you know the story?
It was early part of last century, and some altercation took place, and a white mob essentially wiped out the town.
Right. And I believe it was in the early 1900s. And in the 1920s, somewhere around that time, was the highest number of lynchings of Black Americans since slavery. lots of towns in the South, a lot of towns suffered from more lynching than had happened since slavery. And then in Rosewood, that happened 80 years ago or more. But in 1994, 71 years after the Rosewood Massacre, in which white lynch mobs, during a week-long orgy of hate, killed six blacks and drove survivors into the swamps near a prosperous black community in Florida and basically burned down the town, Governor Lawton Childs signed a law that provided for payment of $2.1 million in reparations to the descendants of the blacks of Rosewood. So we sort of see that and this was, 71 years later, the case of reparations was brought before the governor of Florida. And then currently, there are debates going on in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa, Oklahoma also experienced one of the worst race riots in United States history. More blacks were killed, more property was damaged than the bombing of the building that happened. I can't remember the name of the federal building in Oklahoma. Yet the victims of that, and this Tulsa, Oklahoma was considered the Black Wall Street of the United States because there were more affluent middle class black families living in Tulsa, Oklahoma than anywhere else in the United States, and the whole community was destroyed. And so now there's current debate in Tulsa, Oklahoma over the last couple years about reparations and if there should be reparations. And so that whole conversation is happening. And the arguments against that are, it happened a long time ago. People of Tulsa should not be responsible for what happened, the sins of their fathers. So there are lots of debates about it. And underneath that current of the debates, I've heard some of the debates, and what you hear is not just that the current children should not be responsible for the sins of their fathers, but that there is no basis upon which we owe anything to the black citizens of Tulsa, Oklahoma, or their descendants who lost their life. And then recently in Chicago of all places, are you surprised by that, Ingrid?
Yeah.
Chicago of all places, by almost a unanimous vote, there was only one councilman who voted against it, voted to study the question of reparations. And after very dramatic and tearful hearings, the city council, under the direction of Mayor Richard Daley, voted to look at this issue of reparations in the city of Chicago. I find that I'm still suspicious of it, but I do find it quite interesting. I mean, I think it's quite interesting that the question is being called to the table. I mean, that to me at this point is an important issue. And it's a point that Randall Robinson makes in his book. I mean, he talks about reparations and the reasons for reparations. But what he talks about is that we really need to have an honest public debate about the cost of racism in this country. And that if it leads to reparations, and some people will couch this discussion in several different ways. And some people put the discussion of reparations in monetary ways, and others put the discussion of reparations in more sort of a spiritual context. So there are lots of sort of ways. I don't know if any of you from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area? I know that there was a big conversation that was there about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and there were some African-American religious leaders. James Foreman was one, and Renita Weems, who's an African-American theologian, was another, and they raised the issue in a much more sort of broad theological context. I just want to also, this was, I found this in the bookstore. So a plug for the bookstore, you know, if you're going to a session, then there's a book there you want, buy that, because these are there. So I encourage you to buy this. But this is coming up in the next several weeks. And so I found it in there, and it's called Reconciliation, Our Greatest Challenge, Our Only Hope by Curtis Paul DeYoung. And I find it fascinating, and I find it ties in a whole lot to the conversation about race, to the conversations that Dan is having about the German church, and to the whole issue of reconciliation. It's just amazing to me how we're sort of coming full circle here. But I just want to kind of read a couple of things. Sort of this church is called, so why now? I mean, why now this conversation about reparations? I mean, why now? I mean, what's going on?
Well, for one thing, there's lots of money around.
Yeah, that's a good reason.
Well, I mean, Republicans are talking about putting George Bush in there and giving me a tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want a tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need a tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
But if we could do something about healing the ills that are tearing the company apart, the country apart, the gap that we all talk about, the rich and the poor, and use some monies there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want a tax cut.
Somebody just recently told me that in the state of Minnesota, is there anybody here from Minnesota? Okay, so I was asking about Minneapolis, but in the state of Minnesota, you know that they have that interesting governor in Minnesota, right? You know, whatever his name is, the boxer, the weightlifter, or whatever his name is. And I asked someone in conversation, so when are you guys going to get rid of this guy? I mean, he's an interesting kind of guy. And they said, you know, he is, but he has good people around him. And they just sort of had this big windfall from the state, or whatever you call it, from the state, and that they've taken all their money and put it into schools. So, you know, in some states, from welfare reform, you know, the states are sort of cutting down their welfare rolls. So it's amazing to me. We don't want to give welfare, which, you know, we understand all that. But then there's money, you know, and so isn't the idea not to have money? I mean, it seems like to me the question is that we wouldn't have money, we shouldn't have that money, but the money is there. So there's always money floating around somewhere. The question is, what are the priorities and where do we put the money? And in Minnesota, they've sort of taken this windfall from welfare reform and sort of putting it in schools. And I'm sure you might want to find out where your state is putting its excess welfare reform money. And I think our state is probably putting it in the rolls.
Texas isn't using it.
There isn't. So they're sitting on it like it's, you know.
Arizona is building more prisons.
Okay. So this whole issue, there's more money around. So okay. So what are we doing? What are we doing with this money? Well, the other thing that's kind of happening is the churches are calling for. I mean, this whole conversation about the apology for slavery, and the notion that, you know, now there is this call either to apologize or that we are apologizing for slavery. And so in this book it sort of says, in the decade of the 1990s, reconciliation became big news in church life. I don't know about the Lutheran church and the Brethren church. I'm a Brethren, so I don't know where they're at on at least this issue around apology. The Southern Baptist Convention, and isn't this the same convention that just said that women could no longer be ordained? It's quite interesting. These people can't quite get it right. The Southern Baptist Convention offered a public apology to African Americans for the involvement of Southern Baptists in slavery. And then recently, the Roman Catholic Pope John Paul II of Rome came together for a service in Rome offering a joint blessing and an apology for slavery and the oppression of women and the equality of sexes. Several Christian organizations in the United States have issued a call for reconciliation. The Pentecostal, the National Black Evangelical Association, and the Pentecostal Fellowship of North America have joined together, have disbanded their group and joined together the Pentecostal Charismatic Churches of North America. So the churches have sort of called this question of at least reconciliation, the apology. And so a lot of the conversation, a lot of the public conversation is, so what is this apology all about? Is saying you're sorry just enough? And so that calls to sort of the notion of cheap grace. And I bought that book. I bought that book, and I have to say, I'm not a Lutheran. I had not heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but he says something that I think is important. And he said something in the early 1900s that I think is really important to the year 2000. And it's something that I think the churches ought to hear about cheap grace. And what is the cost? What is the cost of slavery? Let's see, there's one other thing I want to read. The costly process. It says reconciliation is a process. We can state the problems with precision, proclaim the biblical mandate with eloquence, and commit ourselves to the principle. But unless we engage in a process, we will never experience reconciliation. And again, I think some of what Randall Robinson talks about is dollars and cents, but also the process. And do we allow ourselves to engage in that process? And I believe that the process of reconciliation must include the following steps: taking responsibility, seeking forgiveness, repairing the wrong, and I think that's the reparations piece, repairing the wrong, healing the soul, and creating a new way of relating. So there certainly is, I think, in the spiritual world, a case for looking at reparations as a source of reconciliation. So historically, where have we been on this question? In 1993, John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers, who's a senior congressman in Congress, probably will never be president, a black Democrat from Detroit, introduced to Congress a bill to acknowledge the fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery in the United States and the 13 colonies between 1619 and 1865, and to establish a commission to examine the institution of slavery. this bill went to committee, but it never made it out of committee. And this was in 1993. So why now? So what is the...
I think there might be one other thing about the climate that we're living in now that is interesting, and that's this whole Jubilee 2000 stuff. You know, the sense that globally there's a need to address global injustice, and that, forgiveness of third world debt on the part of rich and powerful nations is something that we need to take very seriously and act on. And that's a sort of another way in which we think about justice and economics and combine them somehow. And I don't know how it fits in here, but it seems like it's sort of a part of the scene.
So it looks like the timing is right. I mean, it looks as if the forces for even raising this question about reparations is a timing question in lots of ways. So the question I want to ask, and I want to get you guys talking, because I am starting to think about this topic of reparations and the whole issue, and sort of what's the movement around the call for reparations, and where is America, and where could America be, I guess? So I guess what I thought maybe we would do is I could ask you if you could maybe turn your chairs around and maybe find a little group of four or five people. And I guess my initial question would be, what would be the basis, what is the basis upon which African Americans ask for reparations? What's the basis for reparation? What are we asking to be compensated for? What's the basis of the compensation? Do you have a sense of what I'm asking? So what's the cost? And if we're going to calculate some cost, the cost is based upon what? What are the factors that would be involved in putting a price tag on the cost of slavery and the cost of racism in this country?
So that's two questions, right?
Well, okay, maybe that's two questions. You got it? And maybe we could just spend a few minutes. Does that make sense? Because I'd like to hear. I think part of the question is so what are we asking for reparations for? What is the debt? I mean, that's the question. What is the debt, and what's the basis of the debt? And what's your sense of what the debt is? What is the basis? If people say, I mean, young people say today, we're not responsible for slavery. Slavery is over 200 years ago or 150 years ago. So what is the debt? Those slaves are dead, they're gone. Slavery was over in 1865. What is the debt? What is the basis of the debt? So that's the question that I'm asking.
I think that's probably the most obvious question, the most asked question. What is the debt? Why? You know, that happened before. That's gone. It's over with. Mm-hmm. But what most people don't realize is that we're still living with this legacy of pain.
So then that's the question. What is the legacy? What are the particulars around that legacy that add up?
Well, yeah, because now it all boils down to money. And Karen and myself are struggling a lot right now because she just came back from Chiapas in Mexico. Mm-hmm. She's seen this war against the poor, particularly the indigenous people of Mexico, continuing after 500 years, it's the same thing. Nothing has changed. And then on the way up here, we were listening to books on tape, and we heard about the history of the Cherokee people, mm-hmm. and the history of Crazy Horse. As we're driving through this beautiful country, I mean, we're just this most gorgeous land in the world, and we're listening on the tape, and we're finding out how this land was stolen with deceit, with violence, with such greed. The land was torn away from these people who adored this land, and now they're gone. But yet people are living in these beautiful wet valleys, grazing cattle, these beautiful homes, and on boats and jet skis, and just living it up on this land that was stolen in the most horrible, deplorable way, and we had to keep turning the tapes off because we couldn't live with the fact that this violence. It probably would have been okay, well not okay, but we would have been able to deal with it if it wasn't happening anymore. Mm-hmm. You know. But it's still going on, and then we act as though it's over, mm-hmm. and it's not over. Mm-hmm.
I'd like for you to get in a small group and have that conversation. And these are sort of the things I want you to think about, the things that you've lifted up: lost life and economic benefits of slavery, the psychic damage, relationships to race and class. What is the debt? And so if you could just do that for a minute, and then we can just come back and have. Before the bell rings, I'm wondering if we could, if we have time to kind of join back some of these conversations.
You're not having a lot of sleep.
I know. That's what happens when you give it over. Well, we have a few minutes before they're going to be ringing that bell. And I think what I ask you to do, in some ways, will be quite honestly what those folks who are lifting up this debate will be asking us, you know, as Americans and certainly as Black Americans or people of color on this side and as white Americans, to be engaging in these conversations about what is the cost, what are we being asked, what are we asking for, and what is the basis of those costs, and right down to some real specific monetary reparations. So it won't just be an apology, but it'll be really looking at sort of monetarily, what does that mean? And some legal folks have already started the discussion. And so this one says, Robert Wesley, who's at Tulane University Law School, says, compensation to Blacks for the injustices suffered by them must first and foremost be monetary. So sort of pinning a dollar amount on that. So what were some of the things that came up in your discussions?
I heard Randall Robbins speak on public radio about this, and it was 6 months ago, and I don't remember all of it, but he was relating to the monetary part, I believe, as to a form of scholarship for young people who would be paid for their education, mm-hmm. If they had a plan and, you know, a goal in mind that would thus satisfy the reparation. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a very specific...
And which would, in effect, benefit all of society, because then that person would have a job that would provide for his family or her family, mm-hmm. and be a service to others also. Mm-hmm.
So what other? On what basis? So what is the claim? You know, I send you a bill, and I said, this is the bill, these are the itemized claims. What are those itemized claims? I don't think America's just going to say, okay, send us a bill, we're going to pay it.
One of the things that came up in our group was a lot of Black people have no idea what their family history was. They don't know who their great-grandparents were, where they came from, where we know that. And even our own Native Americans, although we weren't that kind to them, at least they have that. They have their ancestors, mm-hmm. where people were enslaved, which they don't. Mm-hmm.
So one of the items on that checklist is the cost of a lost history.
Yeah.
What is the cost?
How do you make
lost
reparation for
this? Mm-hmm. Family awareness.
Okay. And so if we make it more specific, what is the cost of stolen history? Because as the case is for Native Americans and others, there's some real tangible things which were stolen. So we could put a price tag on what are the real tangible things. And one of the things that Randall Robinson goes through is sort of that pre-slavery time, the time that predated slavery in Africa. What was stolen? What did Europe actually steal from Africa? I mean, there was plenty of gold there. There was plenty there. What was actually stolen? That's a real tangible, you could put a real tangible dollar amount somewhere. I mean, obviously, not quite that easy. So a lost history. that also means just a loss, our lost artifacts. So what else? What other kinds of things?
This is a materialistic culture right now. Mm-hmm. We think in terms of dollar and cents. Mm-hmm. If we return money, we are at least acknowledging in our most common knowledge, language, that we do acknowledge that there was something wrong and we want to do something about it. Mm-hmm. It's not, it sounds awfully crass, but it's saying something. Mm-hmm.
If we're willing to pay, then we can, I mean, our most precious thing in this world is our dollar. And if we're willing to put our dollar there, then we must believe that there's a reason why we're putting our dollar there. Okay? And I think that's an enormous, I mean, whether the dollars ever get there or not, but that says something enormous about America's admitting to having done something wrong, which is quite different than what America kind of has admitted to up to this point.
But if the money is paid, I don't think it will ever be paid. Let's just assume it is paid, and African Americans do not achieve equality. Is the debt over?
Well,
then we would say they had their chance, they flubbed it. No guilt. Price is paid.
Do you think that the money's going to come quite that easy?
Oh, I don't think it'll come, period.
But I think so, too, that some people might say, well, you know, we paid the price, now what's the complaint? Because they make it kind of too easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. I mean, I like the idea of scholarship. I mean, that's the town of Florida that had $2 million. Everybody got $5 or what?
I think they put it towards land and education. And it was just to the descendants of, it didn't go to the whole population, it just went to the descendants of the Rosewood Massacre.
Yeah. But okay, land and education.
Investing in the future.